please.
Thank you, and let me just start by thanking Akim and Rob for inviting me to speak here at what I think has been a very successful conference. So yes, I'm going to talk about localized non-inertial observers, and particularly in relation to quantum communication. An alternative title would be putting quantum optics together with quantum field theory. And we did hear from Jason Dukas and Anjay Dragan earlier this week about these sorts of ideas. I'm specifically going to be emphasizing the communication aspect in today's talk. This is our group at the University of Queensland, a slightly dated photo. You've all already heard from Jacques, and you'll hear from Casey later today. But this particular talk, my co-workers are Tony Downs and Nathan Walk. Quick advertisement before I get started. We will be having a RQI in the Southern Hemisphere down in Australia again. This is the sixth one, and that'll be in late November. So just keep an eye on the ISRQI website for information about that, or email me. I just thought I'd throw this picture up here from one of our first meetings, second meeting, sorry, in 2008, and there's a few familiar faces there. Okay, so let me just start by sort of making a pictorial comparison of the way sources and measurements are done in relativistic quantum field theory versus quantum optics. So in relativistic quantum field theory, we are generally dealing with global field states. So the Minkowski vacuum or the Hartle-Hawking vacuum, states like this. And our detectors are generally modeled as two-level systems that are weakly coupled isotropically to the field. The good thing about this is that it leads to rigorous theoretical treatments of non-inertial systems. On the other hand, in quantum optics, we tend to deal with well-localized sources, directional sources like lasers going through nonlinear crystals, and macroscopic detectors, such as this Homodyne detector represented here. Because we have 20 or 30 years of experience of modeling these things and comparing them to experiments, we know very well that these are excellent models for what goes on in the lab. So the strength of quantum optics is that it's an experimentally verified theory for directional sources and localized detectors, as is needed in communication systems. But so far, or up until recently, restricted to inertial systems. So just to say a little bit more about what goes on in quantum optics, sources are normally modeled as unitary transformations on the vacuum. Various non-unitary effects can easily be added to these. And the detectors are modeled as Hermitian operators constructed from the field modes. And then expectation values can be taken to get average values of experimental outcomes. Typically, this object here is an excellent representation of the photocurrents. And typically in an experiment, those photocurrents will be integrated for some time to get an experimental, to get an average value. And so we can predict such values through an expectation value like this. So all these A, Bs, and Cs are mode annihilation operators. So what we want to do is now accelerate Bob and turn him into Rob. And the thing that's going to change is that now the natural expression of Rob's detector is in Rindler modes, whilst Alice's source is in Minkowski modes, and so we're going to have to make a Bogoliubov transformation between those two before we can evaluate this expectation value. So just a quick overview of how I'll go about discussing this. I'll start with discussing the problem a bit. So we have heard discussions of this earlier from Jason and Anjay. So I'll go through this reasonably quickly. I just want to highlight a few things and remind you of a few things. Then I'll do an example of how we can use homodyne detection, localized homodyne detection, to look at the Uinru radiation. So this is a simple example which hopefully you can follow in some detail. And then I'll talk about the more complicated problem of doing quantum communication between Alice and Rob. Okay, so we're interested in space-time, but normally we take all the matter and light and everything out of it. So we've got a vacuum, and of course we can put in Minkowski coordinates, but as we've heard several times, one can also use Rindler coordinates, thus restricting the fields to the two wedges, and it can be shown that those two wedges are entangled. And the result of the entanglement, one result of the entanglement, is that we go from a situation of there being no radiation to there being radiation. So mathematically, and we saw this in the last talk, we have the Minkowski vacuum written in terms of Rindler coordinates as this entangled state, which is a two-mode entangled state, but with a very complicated frequency structure. And that complication will be an issue as we go through. And of course, this corresponds to accelerated trajectories in the normal way. Once again, as we heard, if you're only looking at one of the wedges, then you're going to have to trace out the other wedge and you're going to get a thermal state. So as was commented again by Yorma, this is all a discussion in terms of global modes. So in order to find out what happens if we have a localized detector, then the typical approach is to introduce a two-level quantum system, the so-called Unruh-DeWitt detector, couple it weakly to the field, then accelerate it, and calculate, using perturbation theory, its response. And then you can show that its response is equivalent to being in a thermal bath. But this isn't really a very good model if you're thinking about communication. If I'm trying to communicate with someone, then I'm hoping that they've got a detector that's directional, efficient, unlike and macroscopic, unlike this two-level quantum system, which is weakly coupled and isotropic. So that's what we want to get away from. So you could look at the modes, and you know, the first thought is to use the modes to try and construct your detector, like the quantum optics situation. And in fact, that's what we're going to do. But taking this approach has been held up in the past because of this very complicated frequency structure. As we heard in some other talks again, one way around this is to go to the Unruh modes, which removes much of this frequency structure and gives you something that can be solved quite straightforwardly. But there's a number of problems with this. Firstly, the Unruh modes are not very physical in the first place. There's a localization problem when you do this. And basically, they're not the natural modes that a source in Minkowski space is going to be using. So we don't want to do that. So let's just see how this problem arises if we're trying to do this communication scenario. So we've got these Bogoliubov transformations here, and we're wanting to act them onto the vacuum. So if that unitary wasn't there, then acting them onto the vacuum would indeed give this rather complicated state, which is a bit nasty to work with, but you can imagine that it becomes completely intractable if you put in this unitary here, which is going to mix up all sorts of number states and is going to make the whole thing a total mess. But there's actually a quite straightforward way to get around this problem. So what I've shown here is the Schrodinger picture way of doing things. What we're doing is we're taking Alice's initial state and we're re-expressing it in terms of Bob's Rindler modes. But we could turn this around and just put the brackets in a different place and instead use the Bogoluboff transformation to transform Rob's detector modes into Minkowski modes, and then we can act the unitaries on those modes, and in the end we'll get some operator expression where we just take the expectation value over the Minkowski vacuum. Now that just looks like I've shuffled brackets around, but it turns out that is a tractable thing to do, far more tractable than the other approach that I just outlined. So that's what we're going to do, and we can still calculate all expectation values of various moments. It turns out, as long as you're using Gaussian states, then you only need the first and second order expectation values to tell you everything about what's going on. Okay, so let me just outline this in a bit more detail. So we've got these are the global, the detector mode, one of the mode operators that we're using to construct Rob's detector, expressed in Rindler coordinates. So we've got these global Rindler coordinates here, these single frequency Rindler coordinates, and then we are making a superposition of these using this function, which is going to produce the localized mode which the detector detects. So we know how to transform from these single frequency modes to the Minkowski modes. It's just a Bogoluboff transformation. And so then we can write down what Bob's detector mode looks like just in this way. Okay, and this is equivalent just to this B dagger B term in our detector, in our expectation value. And fortunately, these Bogoluboff coefficients appearing in here were calculated back in the 80s in 3D by Tagaji. So these are expressions we're going to use. Okay, so let's look back at the problem. So this is the full thing that we want to do, but let's do a simpler case first to illustrate the techniques. So let's just make the source the vacuum. Okay? And Rob is going to do homodyne detection on the vacuum. And hopefully we're going to see Unruh radiation. So we need to discuss what mode function we're going to use for Rob's detector. So what we want is something that's spatially and temporally localized. So what we're going to take is this function here. So this f is mathematically in the calculation just flat. So this detector is flat for all frequencies. This means that when you Fourier transform it, it's a delta function in time. So we've at particularly this time tau. Okay, so I'll outline in a moment under what conditions this is obviously an approximation, but under what conditions this approximation is okay. So Rob is going to need a local oscillator, and he's going to get this by displacing the vacuum. So now the vacuum he's going to naturally have is the Minkowski vacuum, and he's going to displace this by an amplitude beta. And this is going to serve as a local reference. So we need a waveform for this. So he's basically creating a coherent pulse of radiation, which is going to be his reference pulse. You can assume that it's a Gaussian like this, centered around some frequency with some width. Important thing is that beta is much larger than 1. So the 1 here appears because beta is in units of square root photons. So what we're saying is that it's going to be much larger than any sort of single photon effects. By doing this, it turns out that the noise that comes in from the Minkowski vacuum will be irrelevant. So if you have a large enough local oscillator, and it doesn't matter if it has a bit of noise on it, it just acts like a classical reference. Okay, so let's just see how this calculation goes in just a few equations. So I'm sorry, I've changed the nomenclature a little bit between here and here. So when I write BS, I'm meaning the signal, which I'm just writing as B here. And when I write BL, I'm meaning the local oscillator, which is labeled as C here. So this is what the detector sees. This phi here is the phase, the relative phase between the local oscillator and the signal, which in this case means nothing because the signal's just the vacuum. Okay, so if we look, so this is the first order expectation value. So that's going to be zero because I'm just looking at the vacuum. So on average, the vacuum is zero. So more interesting is to look at the variance. Okay, so that term is zero. So all we really have to calculate is this thing, which is the average of the square of this integrated photocurrent represented by this operator. Now you can appreciate that this expression is going to be very complicated because it's got these operators here that have all these integrals across both Minkowski modes and Rindler modes. But it turns out that this can be simplified a real lot. If you have beta very large, then basically all the quantum terms associated with the local oscillator go away. And we only get quantum terms coming from the signal, the vacuum. So secondly, here I've just indicated that what is the physical requirement for this F being flat, which is basically just that it's flat across the frequencies of the local oscillator. So the detector catches all the frequencies of the local oscillator. If we put those two conditions in, then a whole heap of delta functions turn up, collapsing all the integrals except one, and we end up with this expression here. So you can see the thermal term coming from the Bogoluboff transformations. This thing here is the mode function of the local oscillator. So what you see is that you're integrating across this frequency distribution of the local oscillator with this thermal term present. So in principle, you could work that out exactly, but let me just make one more approximation, which is to say that this local oscillator mode is quite sharp, so the width is small compared to its absolute frequency. Something I didn't mention is, so this central point of the local oscillator, the A appears here. This is because in the Takagi formalism, we use unitless wave vectors. And so when you use that definition to look at what the actual wave vector numbers should be, then you get this factor of A. So this is where it comes in, what trajectory Rob is actually on. So with this approximation, we can take this term outside the integral by just putting in the average value to the k dash, and then the remaining bit of the integral just goes to 1 due to normalization. And we get this function here, which is indeed exactly what you'd expect a homodyne detector to see if it was looking at a thermal bath at the Rindler temperature. Okay, so it works. So let's now, and I should comment that this is all, I've suppressed all the other dimensions here, but the Bogoluboff transformation formations are defined in 3D, and you can show that this is an isotropic effect. So no matter which way Rob looks, he sees this thermalization. Okay, so now let's go to the somewhat more difficult case of where we're not just looking at some vacuum mode, but we're actually looking at this source produced by Alice. So let's pick a particular source. Let's imagine that Alice is sending coherent states to Rob. So these coherent states are represented by this U being a displacement by alpha. Alpha is a complex number, and she's going to send messages by sending different alphas. So she can send two independent numbers this way, the real part and the imaginary part of the complex amplitude. Okay. So this thing is varying. This is our signal. So we also need a local oscillator, though. And Rob's local oscillator needs to be phase locked with Alice's laser. Now, this is a problem just for inertial systems. It's quite difficult to arrange. And you can imagine that now that I've got a non-inertial Rob whose clock is ticking at a different rate to that of Alice, then it's even more difficult. But there's a pretty straightforward solution, and that is just that Alice not only sends the signal, but she also sends the phase reference. So these two are phase locked because they will have originated from the same laser. And so Rob gets a local oscillator, which is basically his classical reference, and the signal, and he does homodyne detection with those. So that's the scenario we're going to look at. Again, we've got Rob's detector modeled like this. And again, we've got these sharp modes for Alice's two coherent states. Sorry, I should add that the difference here is that alpha is the signal, so it's any complex number. Beta is some specific large complex amplitude. It's always staying the same. A note here, we can kind of have our cake and eat it too here with these signal modes. What we require is that this is broad with respect to frequency oscillations, if you like, if I'm thinking about this in spatial terms, but it's also high frequency. Sorry if that didn't make terribly much sense, but what I'm aiming here is that we want to have something that is pretty well localized around a particular frequency. So this is now the average local oscillator and signal frequency, KSO, and also well localized around some space-time point, XT. So this is where the source is, this is the position and time that the source is sending the signal, and this is the frequency of the signal. Also, I make a rather unrealistic assumption about the transverse modes, that is that Rob is able to use some gigantic lens to focus the beam coming from Alice down onto his detector to exactly match the shape of his detector. If this was over a short distance, this would be no problem, but over large distances, it would be. But it's easy to relax this, but I'll just leave it in for the moment. Okay, so I'm not going to go through this calculation in detail. I'll just show you the results. But the kind of approximations used are similar to the ones that I showed in the previous calculation. Okay, so this is the scenario we're going to particularly get results for, but there's many other. It's very easy to treat other scenarios. So we've got Alice sitting here stationary, and she's sending signals to Rob, who is on this accelerated trajectory. So we're only going to consider signals that are sent in this region, so they're all left movers. And we're going to consider signals sent at different times to Rob. and see what happens. So again, using these approximations, you can get analytic results, and they look like this. So here I'm normalizing out the local oscillator amplitude. So I end up with expressions that are only about signal. So here we see the signal sent by Alice. That's this thing here. All right, depending on what phi I pick, I can pull out either the real or imaginary part of alpha. Okay, so this is something I can control, the local oscillator. And you see that it's been amplified. So this term down here is less than one. So this is the first thing to observe. The signal sent by Alice turns up at Rob as an amplified signal. So now we can look at the noise. So this is just this V thing, again, getting rid of the beta. And again, we see this thermal term, although the details of the argument in the exponentials are somewhat different. Now, in fact, what this is mathematically equivalent to is a linear amplifier with a gain given by this. So the effect of the Bogoliubov transformations is to look like you've applied a linear amplifier to the mode coming from Alice. So this gain term, so we see the frequency of Alice's local oscillator, that's what we expect, but we see this time-dependent term, which is perhaps not something we would expect, given that normally we think of the Unruh effect as being a constant along the trajectory. So why is this time term sitting in here? So we'll see the answer to that in a moment. That's probably all I want to say there. So let's see if we can understand this. Let's look at this trajectory here to start with. So Alice sends a signal at this time which arrives at Bob at t equals zero. So this is easy to calculate. So what we need here is what x minus t is for this particular photon path, or signal path, I should say. And, well, this is a geodesic, so x minus t is a constant along it. So all we really need to know is what this coordinate is. Okay, so we're saying it's t equals zero, put t equals zero into here, and you find that this coordinate is actually 1 on A. Put that into our expression, and we get the normal term, the term we got before. A linear amplifier with this gain, if acted on the vacuum, would just give Unruh radiation. So that's fine. But then if we look at these other trajectories, these other beam paths, then we get different results. So on this one, x minus t is going to be less than 1 on A. On this one, it's going to be greater than 1 on A. Right, basically, you can just look at where it cuts the t equals 0 axis, because again, it's the same value all the way along. So what's going on? Why is there apparently a higher gain and therefore more thermal noise at this point than there is and less at this point? I know some of you know the answer. Anyone who doesn't know the answer want to guess? No one wants to stick their neck out. Well, it's very simple. It's just a Doppler shift. The thing is that the frequency that Rob detects his signal at is determined by Alice's local oscillator. And in this region, he's moving away from Alice, and so that local oscillator is redshifted to lower frequencies. And at lower frequencies, there's a stronger Unruh effect, so he sees more radiation. On the other hand, over here, he's coming back towards Alice, so he sees a blue shift, he shifts to higher frequencies, and he gets out of the Unruh radiation. Okay, and so I'm just saying that, but you can calculate what the instantaneous velocities are at the particular points, work out what the Doppler shift is, and see that it's exactly how that frequency is changing. Okay, sorry. Let's use this for doing something. So I've got 7 minutes left. Okay, so let's imagine a quantum communication protocol and see how we can use these results to answer some questions about it. So we're going to look at continuous variable quantum key distribution between Alice and Rob. So we've got this little story here. Alice is on Earth, but Rob is in a spaceship going off to explore planet X. Alice wants to communicate with Rob about what he finds there, but she wants to do it securely because, who knows, Marvin the Martian might be listening in and she doesn't want anything revealed. So they're going to use quantum key distribution in order to do this. So quantum key distribution can be implemented using coherent states. So Alice prepares a random ensemble of coherent states, basically a Gaussian, a two-dimensional Gaussian in the imaginary and real part. Sends it off to Rob. Rob can detect either the real part or the imaginary part, or in fact, in this scenario, he's detecting both at the same time, and can extract a key. And then they have to do communication to reconcile this key. But meanwhile, we've got some potential eavesdropper, or Marvin, in the middle. And we can calculate keys here. So the calculation to work out whether this system is secure is based, in fact, on an equivalent situation in which you use entangled states. So you imagine that Eve actually has a source of entangled states here, one of which she sends to Rob, and the other one she keeps for herself. And you can then look at the purity of the state that's shared between Alice and Rob. And if that state is pure, then there is no eavesdropper. As that state gets more and more mixed, you can put strong bounds on exactly how much information the eavesdropper has got. Now, it's straightforward to adapt what I showed you for coherent states to entangled states. And indeed, you immediately find that these entangled states that are distributed will become decohered by the channel. I should note at this point that this result that the channel is like a linear amplifier was obtained in the Unruh mode scenario by Yvette Fuentes and Gerardo Odesso and I think someone else a few years ago. But now we're seeing it emerge in this more communication relevant scenario. Okay, so you can calculate the keys, and what happens is this: if at early times we're red-shifted into the radiation and we have a problem, the key rate drops. But at later times we blue-shift out, and communication is okay. This is the completely unrealistic scenario of no loss. As soon as you put loss in, then things get a bit more dramatic. You find that there are times now that you can't communicate anymore. There's no secure key, okay? Because Marvin is getting too much information. All right, so let me finish there. I've shown you how to treat localized, directional, macroscopic optical detection when you have accelerated observers. You get a bit of new interesting physics coming out. Let me see. You can get analytical results and under certain reasonable assumptions. And told you a bit about a QKD proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So we have time for a couple of questions.
Uh, How does your key rate depend on the acceleration of a potential non-inertial eavesdropper?
So we've got... So this thing here... Let me just think carefully about this. Sorry, I'm just trying to think whether, in fact, the A is incorporated into this. I mean, in some sense, it's having a different A is just like having a different K, is just like having a different T. They all combine into one expression. But I think this is calculated for a particular A, but I don't know specifically what A that was. But there's a sense in which you can roll everything into this product here.
What happens if an eavesdropper is accelerating not so fast as Bob?
So, oh, sorry, the eavesdropper.
Yeah, eavesdropper.
Sorry. We make no assumptions whatsoever about the eavesdropper.
So it's secure against all...
The calculation just says how mixed is this entangled state that we've distributed. And whatever, we assume that Eve has the purification of that entangled state. All right? So whatever Eve, we assume that Eve has got everything she could possibly get. Is that clear? So it's a very, very strong restriction.
So other questions? No? Oh, okay, let's thank the speaker again. And